The Variety Artist, episode 24. This one's all about a master and his craft. But before we start, on this interview, Leland and I talk about his hand shadow act. Since it is brilliant and inspirational to see, Leland has been kind enough to let me post it on my Facebook page. Just log into your Facebook and search The Variety Artist. You'll see it there. It really is amazing. Also, on that Facebook page, you'll see who I'm interviewing next, and you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. It's your connection to my guests. Enough of me, let's start the show. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. They're offering you, The Variety Artist, a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thevarietyartist.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book right after this podcast and get your free audiobook. Now, let's start the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's an award-winning filmmaker and digital media producer. He has performed and taught at international theater and circus festivals in Hong Kong, Russia, China, Canada, the U.S., and Japan. He uses the techniques and disciplines of acting, mime, writing, story, and magic to create a world of teeming with characters and imagination. Variety Artist, I give you Leland Faulkner.
Hello, world.
How's it going, Leland?
That's doing great, John.
Good. Now, I stayed up late last night watching all of your videos, and I'm a huge fan of yours. But for people who have not seen you yet, tell us what exactly do you do?
I would say that I'm a mime and a magician. Those are my two essential things. And I love to create magic pantomimes and stories and characters using movement.
Mm.
I illustrate almost everything I do with some form of magic effect or a classic of magic, like a chapeauography, which is folding a hat brim into multiple shapes and characters, or shadowgraphs with my hands, making hand shadows.
I've seen both of those. Let's talk about your shadowgraphs first. The shadowgraphs is fascinating. How did you come up with that?
When I was a young boy, I was living in Africa, and we came to the States like every 2 years. So I really wasn't exposed to television. One year when we went to the States, I saw the Ed Sullivan Show. Hmm. And there was a fellow, I think he's Israeli, Albert Almozenino.
Okay.
And I saw him do a hand shadow act. And I never forgot it. I just was always there in the back of my mind after seeing that. Years later, I was working with Tony Montanaro, the incredible mime master. And he let me do hand shadows as part of the warm-up in the show. And so I started developing the whole routine. And over the years, it just has evolved and grown. It's become a staple in my repertoire.
The routine is great.
Thank you.
I was just thinking, the neat thing about your shadowgraph art is, you know, you show the first few pieces with your hands. And then after you see the first two, as an audience member, I start using my own imagination, probably helping you picturing a bunny or sure, a rooster or whatever it may be.
Right. When I perform for kids, of course, you know, they're calling out all the animals and I make all the sounds myself. There's nothing recorded. All the animal sounds I make, and it's more like doing almost like a martial art, like doing a kata, mm-hmm, you know, doing a form, because I've been doing it so long. And it's body memory at this point. Although I'm working on new shadows that you haven't seen yet. I'm working on Donald Trump, and I've got Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and other famous celebrities, but they don't really work for children, so I don't often do them as much as I do the other shadows, which are just animals.
Donald Trump isn't going to go over so well in a elementary or middle school. Huh?
That's right.
Actually, it may not even go over well in a high school. I'm not sure.
Well, it depends on how you transform him and what you transform him into.
Oh, that's a whole nother path to go down.
Yeah. But as I said, it's a very flexible art form. You know, a shadow can take almost on the character of almost anything. I've done productions where we've used whole bodies and teams of bodies to do productions. I was a adjunct professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, and over about a two-year period, I worked with 10 students at the school, and we put together a production called Shadow Play, and it was ensemble movement, people working with both video, different kinds of lights, shadows from the front, shadows from the back, but everything was based on shadows, and the whole story was based on Shadow Play.
Now let's move into your all the different characters that you do. It's crazy. I went on your website and I watched, of course, I watched your videos, and you have World of Wonder, which is kind of an African, it's not an African, it's an Orient thing. Doc Hokum's traveling medicine show. So yeah. You do this crazy doc. Well, let's start with World of Wonder.
World of Wonder is a show that's sort of grown organically over time. It started out as a family concert. I've made different versions of it for different situations. For example, in schools, I have a 45-minute version, and then I have a concert version. And the concert version includes an animation that I created years ago called The Sky God's Dance.
Oh, yeah.
It's a shadow puppet animation.
So you actually perform that live?
Yes. Sometimes I do the storytelling part of it, and sometimes I just play it as is. An interesting thing happened, actually, in the making of that movie. It only happens when you do single-frame animation. It doesn't happen if you do, like, three-click animation, which is another way of doing it. Mm-hmm. But you enter sort of a trance state from the hours that it takes to make these simple movements. You know, a minute can take you 8 hours. It was a trance state, and I actually saw the animation playing out in front of me in slow motion.
Oh.
It was the most unusual experience I've ever had.
Are you talking about like an out-of-body experience, like you're actually seeing it?
It's not really out of body. It's just like you're looking at the light board where you have your cutouts, and you're moving everything very slowly, but you're seeing the whole story as it's being played out.
Mm.
It's so interesting. I've never had a trance state like that occur to me before.
Huh.
That whole film came about because I spent 7 years as a boy growing up in East Africa. Oh. And I wanted to do something that sort of captured that whole feeling.
Well, I spent 7 years as a boy also.
Yes. That's good.
Now, wait.
Better than as a monkey or something.
Am I hearing a dove in your background?
Yes. I have a bird that tours with me all over the world.
The reason I say that is because I'm always interrupted by my dove in the background.
And I'm trying to, I tried to isolate myself away from this thing, but the voice is just...
It's funny when somebody hears my dove for the first time, they go, oh, isn't that soothing? And then I say, not the first 100 or 200 times you hear it.
Sometimes in the hotel rooms, you're just like, stop.
Yeah. Shh. I didn't pay extra for the doves. I was talking over the last couple of weeks to Mike Miquelon.
Oh, sure.
And Michael Troutman. And we were talking about the Celebration Barn.
Yes.
There's a lot of history there, and you were or are a co-owner of that?
I was an owner of it in the 80s. I owned it. I bought it from Tony with a business partner. For 4 years, I was the artistic director and owner. At that time, it was just Tony's playground for him to teach workshops and to work on material and have a little theater. And I internationalized the roster, bringing master teachers from Italy and from around the world and in various specialties, like everything from stage combat to commedia dell'arte to neutral mask and mask work. And so I wanted to bring master teachers that if you came and you took a whole summer, which I had a few students do, like Steve Ragatz, who's a great juggler with Cirque du Soleil, he took all the workshops one summer. And it gives you this incredible foundation because you know how to do stage combat, do voice work. So you got a real strong foundation for all the skills that you need in theater. So that was a dream of mine, and it came about. And I'm proud to say that Celebration Barn is still doing international workshops with master teachers from around the world.
And did you teach there, or did you organize the whole thing?
Both. I taught and organized it, and did the maintenance, and tried to keep the doors open.
So when they look at your resume, it's like artistic director, co-owner, and sweeper.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have any crazy stories from back then?
we had a storefront theater called Mime Walk.
Mm.
We had devised this little restaurant scene where we'd sit down at the table and a chafing dish would be brought out with some little forks. I would take little balls of cotton and set them on fire because the chafing dish was full of Coleman fluid. Uh-huh. And I also had a little water glass with Coleman fluid on it too.
Okay.
Because then later I could blow fire. Right? Oh. So I'd dip this thing and light these little balls and eat them and put the flame on my tongue and pass it from thing to thing. But we were so cheap, poor, I should say, that we didn't have a real table. So we improvised a table. We had a big, huge cardboard tube made for cement casting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a piece of board. And we just put the board on top of the tube. And I covered it with this little picnic tablecloth, red and white check. And it looked like a table for all the world.
Great.
So that's what we're going to do.
Okay.
So the table's all set with all these materials. And Steve comes out. He's the waiter. I'm the customer.
Okay.
And he sets down the chafing dish, which is on fire. He sets it down. And as he does, the table tips.
Oh, no.
Because it's not secured. And the glass of Coleman fluid goes all over the table. And the whole thing is a huge ball of fire. And I'm staring at it. I look up at Steve, and he's got a glove on, and his glove has a foot of flame coming off it. And he doesn't change character. He still maintains this very sort of posh waiter attitude, and he like just flips it and puts it under his armpit and puts it out, and he walks off stage.
Oh.
And leaves me there at this green table. And I see Mike Troutman off stage left. I take this flaming tabletop, and I like put it on this metal cart, and I go, "Put it out. Put it out." Uh-huh. And I walk back on stage to somehow finish this sketch. And what am I thinking? Why should I even go out and finish the sketch? But I did. It's like the show must go on. And Steve comes out, and we're standing, to this day, I can't remember what we were saying to each other, standing in this downlight. And I look off to stage left, and I see Michael's like running around like a crazy man, looking for some way to put this thing out. He takes a jacket and he starts like beating the flames with the jacket, and I see the jacket catches on fire.
Oh, great.
And so he eventually finds this fire extinguisher, thank God, and he I can see he's putting it out. Shh. He put it out. Oh, great. And then I look off stage to give him a smile. He looks at me with the most wicked face I've ever seen in my life. It's like, and he just releases the extinguisher onto the two of us downlight, and it just covers us in this cloud. And then it goes into the audience, and the audience starts going, and so we evacuate everybody out of the theater. They're all standing in a line outside the door. And then because it's so nasty in there, we also come out that door. As we come out, everybody applauds us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we did that on purpose.
That's my horror story, or one of them.
That was completely planned.
Yeah.
Is that the only one you can think of?
I've had other horror stories, being on the road more than being at the barn.
Bring it on.
Oh, well, having the flu, and you know, you walk off stage and you puke in a bucket, and then you walk back on stage and you smile and do your show and then go off stage and repeat, you know, rinse and repeat.
I've been lucky. I've never, I felt like throwing up on stage, but I never have.
Yeah. And actually that was a show that Michael and I were doing in Kansas, and we had a door as a prop. I remember we had this huge door. We'd put this door prop, the set piece, in a trailer, and we were driving down this forsaken highway in Kansas. I look in the rearview mirror and I see sparks. I go, what? And I see the trailer bouncing down the highway behind us all by itself. It's like, oh my God.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and we had to run back and reconnect the whole thing, and it's like it had just come loose. I was so lucky that there was no one behind us. I remember at the barn, I think Mike Troutman was hanging some lights, and I was footing the ladder as he was up in the grid. The phone rang. I thought, oh, let's grab it. And I went over to grab it and I realized that the ladder is sliding out from underneath him. Oh, and no. I leapt about 10 feet and put my foot at the base of the ladder and just saved him from hanging from the grid.
It would have been funny.
You wouldn't have forgiven me, I don't think.
Now, you performed and taught at international theater and circus festivals all over the world?
Yeah, I've been touring. Actually, did a lot of circuses. Montreal and a big circus festival in China called the Wuchao Festival. And I think they televised that on Chinese television. So in that one performance, millions and millions of people saw the show. It's like more people than will ever see you performing live.
Wow.
And then the last place was in Iveshk, Russia. That is an amazing place. They have built a circus building that looks like a futuristic 50s vision of architecture. It's got this big dome. It seats about 4,000 people. And the show is a 4-hour show.
Oh, wow.
With artists from all over the world. And some of the strangest acts you've ever seen.
Like what?
They had a lion tamer doing an act that you would never see in the U.S.
Oh.
He had this lion. Like, he did a standard act, you know, jumping through hoops and having them stand on their little pedestals and do things together as a team. And then he took this one lion and he pulled out a little bulldog, this tiny little bulldog, and he took a stake, and he put a piece of meat on the end of it and put it in the dog's collar.
Oh, no.
And then held the dog up to the lion. And as an audience member, what you're thinking, is it going to be the dog or the meat or both?
So what happened?
The lion very gently, with its teeth, just peels the meat off the stick. And everybody goes, yay, the dog didn't get eaten.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that would never pass PETA here.
I don't think so.
And then they also had two acrobats that came out and bounced on their hands while they were holding machine guns. Mm. Because Iveshk in Russia is where the world's most popular machine gun is made, the Kalashnikov. I think that's one reason why there's a circus there, is because there's the Kalashnikov factory and the circus. And those are the two big things in that city.
So are you thinking of stealing that act and taking it to elementary school? The machine gun act and the lion tamer act with the small dog?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, sure. That'll go over great.
I have in my notes affiliate artist. An artist residency. Tell me about the affiliate artists.
They were an organization based out of New York City that mm-hmm. put mid-career artists into communities that were underserved, but that had like a large corporate presence. For example, like GE or Dow Corning. They would present artists of different kinds. It was mimes. It was singers, actors, dancers. They would put them in these communities and you would do these informal performances. It wasn't like you went in and did a show. You actually had a conversation with the audience and maybe you did a performance of some kind, but it was always on a very conversational level.
What type of venues were you working? You're saying underserved communities.
Yes. For example, in a cement factory, I did an informance.
Oh, okay.
They had a Reddy heater in one corner because it was so cold. And I worked on the floor of GE in the factory where they manufacture stuff. Uh-huh. And they would just bring a bunch of workers around and we'd have this conversation about art. And I'd give a little performance and a little talk on mime. And
were GE and the major players, were they sponsoring these?
They sponsor these residencies, or they did at that time. You know, they need promotion and marketing that's really positive. And when you put an artist in to a community, people are having a good time and they start to, you know, they enjoy what you do and make them laugh. It's good for the corporation as a presence. Ah. And it makes them less faceless.
Now, I watched Wonderama with Wally Wiggins.
Yes, he's my latest and greatest.
He is great.
Yeah, he's my latest creation. He works a lot as an MC. I just used that character to MC the SAM National Conference, which is the Society of American Magicians.
Yep.
They had a big national conference down in Orlando this year. And so I was the MC for one of the evening shows.
As Wally Wiggins?
As Wally Wiggins. He's just a great character. Everything goes wrong for him. Gets tangled in microphone cables and drops microphone stands on his feet and tries to do commercial messages that go wrong.
One of the best routines I think I've ever seen is when I saw your linking glasses routine.
Oh, thank you.
Because I'm a magician myself, and I've seen, you know, linking rings, linking rubber bands, linking finger rings, linking this, linking life singers, linking this. But your linking glasses have a great story to it. And that's it. Not only is it great magic, but it also has a wonderful story. How did you come about that?
Well, when I was young, I had to wear those BC glasses as a kid, right?
Okay.
They call it birth control glasses because you wear these these thick black glasses with thick lenses. And I had real Coke bottle lenses. Years later, I got LASIK and I didn't have to wear glasses anymore. But when I was working on this character, I just know how nerdy I always felt as a kid with those thick glasses on. And this character is very much a nerd and very much a wannabe magician. Things go wrong. He tries to do magic, but he always does it in a strange way, or it goes wrong on him. I worked on all kinds of techniques, and I still am working on that whole routine, and it's growing quite a bit. The glasses were just an intrinsic part of his character and a sort of a statement of his look. So first they multiply, and as they multiply, they link, and it just becomes overwhelming. And now at this point, the way I'm performing it now, it expands and expands until I have a handful of about 20 glasses, and then I put them up near my face and suddenly I'm wearing a huge giant pair. It has a natural sort of arc to it. There's a certain idiocy to it that I love. And it's good magic, and it's original magic that people haven't ever seen before because I made it up.
Yeah, it isn't something that you can just look up on the internet and buy.
Right. You know, magic is a very lonely art, especially when it comes to sleight of hand or even hand shadows. You have to sit there by yourself and work this material and find out what is possible with sleight of hand, especially.
So when you started doing that, did it start out as a smaller routine and just grew and grew and grew organically as you continue to explore it?
Yes, it tends to be the way I usually work, although occasionally, sometimes I will come up with an idea that is full born, but I think it's because I had so much in my bank account about it first. An example would be my latest fishing act, which is also sort of a Wally Wiggins character, but that came out because I had both my knees replaced last fall. And I thought that my career might be over. You know, you get when you have major surgeries like that, you feel like, oh, this could be the end.
Ooh.
When I was laid up, I just had this flash on this idea. For years, I did an act called aerial fishing, where you catch fish in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always done it in a very serious way. The moment I took on the idea that it was a comedy, the floodgates opened up, and it became a nice little story, a little arc, and it hit me in a flash while I was laid up. So it was therapy for me. To create this sketch was therapy. It was like an anti-crisis thing. When I figured out how I could make a bowl of water appear from a hat, and I made all this by hand, all these props and things by hand, how to catch fish, real fish that people could see, mm-hmm. to drop into the bowl and swim around, and how I could finish it with this giant fish, this looks like a 30-pound carp.
Oh my gosh.
As a finale. So it had this full arc with a great kicker at the end.
And this is the project that you're working on right now, right?
Yes, Parade. It's one of the main sketches in Parade, which is my new one-man show for adults and families. It's definitely PG. I try to do a magic trick with a rope, but there's no real rope involved. Mm. I levitate this invisible rope. And it's a great thing to have in my repertoire because when I was at Abbott's, which is a big magic conference that happens every year in Colon, Michigan. Yeah, all the great magicians show up there at some time or another. And there's a graveyard there where so many famous magicians are buried.
Mm.
All because they love that place and they love going there. when I was emceeing there with the Wally Wiggins character.
Yeah.
And the fire alarm goes off because John Bundy, and this has all been tested, you know, and the fire department was informed and everything's cool. But he has this huge fog machine and just like blanketed the stage and in the space with fog. So when the curtain opens up, and I'm backstage thinking, oh, everything's fine. Oh, what the hell? And someone goes, MC, MC, MC. I had no idea what I was going to do, but I just ran out. and I did this little thing with levitating this piece of rope, all in pantomime. And because it was magicians, you know, they got it, and they laughed, and nobody left the building.
That's good. I got to tell you, whenever I see a magician pull out ropes, I always think to myself, okay, great, another rope routine. I've seen it a million times. But if you pull out an invisible rope... Tell me about the couple of things I saw. The Gong Show.
Yeah, sure.
Tell me how that all happened.
The Gong Show was a hoot to do. We got gonged, Michael and I. Oh. But it was still a hoot. It was more interesting actually to meet some of the other acts like Chips Cooney, who does like a parody of magic, very ironic sort of act. One of the most interesting things when you walk in is like it's a standard like studio stage, right? There's a big sign with an arrow. Where the chairs are, and the arrow points to where the people are sitting, and it says, "Leave your dignity here." Perfect. and in this business, I think it's really important to have a really thick skin. Do everything in the spirit of fun, and in the spirit of what you want to do. You know, as a casting director, I was a casting director on two features. You get 500 to 1,000 headshots for one role.
Oh, sure.
How do you decide?
Sure. Well, we're going to move into a fun game called Fact or Something John Just Made Up. Does that sound good, Leland?
That sounds good to me.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
So here's how it works. I'm going to read a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little something about, like that. You okay. Get the idea.
Sure.
All right. First line. Leland was photographed in Russia by a suspected mafia KGB officer.
That is true. Oh. That is a fact. I was asked to perform, after performing at the circus with about 3,000 people in attendance, the little circus director, Vladimir, he says to me, "Could you perform at a school for disabled children?" I said, "Oh, I'd love to." He goes, "Oh, you're not like other circus artists." I guess he'd asked some others and they'd all rejected him.
Okay.
So the next morning, he says, "My friend Leon Kapinski will pick you up." And so I'm thinking, okay, he's going to pick me up on one of those little Ladas, you know, those little Russian square sedans. Okay. And he shows up in a brand new black Chevy Tahoe. I mean, you could smell the newness. Uh-huh. And he's our driver. But Vladimir tells me, "Leon is your driver, but he's not really a driver. He's a photographer."
Okay. I go,
"Oh, photographer. Okay, great." And so we go to this school for the disabled kids. It's a walled compound. Leon, the driver, stays in the car, and we go in to the school. And the principal has put out this feast for me. This is 7 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's meat and cheese and bread and vodka.
Oh.
At 7 in the morning. So, you know, it's like prost, and then go off and you do the performance with the kids. Then we come back to her office, and this time there's more food, more vodka, and cognac. Oh. And this time our driver, Leon, is in the room because he knows there's goodies.
Yeah.
Nosvidanya, and down we go with the vodka and everything. I mean, this is the principal's office. If you've done school shows, you know, this is not the same country. So afterwards, he takes me on this little tour of Ivashka as a thank you, right? So Leon is driving me around, and he zooms through the city. He's moving. And then he goes down this esplanade, and he hits the brakes just before, there's just like this lookout area that looks out over this lake. He hits the brakes and he spins this Tahoe in a 180 and reverse parks it.
Oh my.
And my heart is like, dum, 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 dum. And I look up at my interpreter, this beautiful girl named Lada Ladushka. And she goes, did you like that? And I go, and then he takes all these photographs of me in front of this CCP symbol and in front of statues of Kalashnikov by the Kalashnikov factory.
What is that?
The machine gun factory, or the most famous machine gun in the world.
That's right, with the lion tamer and the machine guns.
And right, I ask him, oh, this is a beautiful lake. You know, do people fish? He goes, fish? Obviously not, because you can see the pollution spewing out of the machine gun factory, and it's a dead lake. He says to me, so you photographer? I go, yes. He goes, would you like to see my erotic photographs?
Oh!
I go, and I look at my interpreter. She goes, whatever you wish. Oh. I go, I've been to film school.
Sure.
I studied photography, and maybe these are artistic shots. In Russia, you're only there once, you know, it's a little adventure.
Sure.
Okay. And he goes, oh, okay. He takes us to his apartment, which is in this industrial area. Real architecture of doom, these big gray buildings. And the ground area is all covered with graffiti. And it's an outdoor parking lot where he parks his car. And we go in, steel door, and creaks open, and more graffiti. And then there's this rattle trap brass elevator. It looks like it was out of the 50s with a grate on the front, and tick, 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 all the way up to where his apartment is. And we go in. He opens the door, and there are 8x10s. Covering every square inch of his apartment walls. And they're all the same. All lit the same. All the composition the same. It's a girl looking straight on at the camera, bare-breasted.
Oh.
And they're all just like that. There's no variation. They're all the same, but all different girls.
All different girls with the exact same pose.
Exactly. And I mean, it's floor to ceiling. I mean, it's like, it's like wallpaper. And then he shows me this little bathroom. It just has a jacuzzi tub in it, because the toilets and the tubs are separated in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. And so he goes, look, jacuzzi. So proud of it.
Oh.
And he opens the door to where this toilet is. Like, it's like in a little tiny cubicle. And he pushes me in. I say, I don't really have. He goes, no, koi. So I sit down. When he closes the door, the whole inside of the bathroom lights up like a constellation with all these LEDs everywhere. Then he goes, come, television. And so we go into the living room area where he is. But as we do, I walk past what at one time was his dining room, I think. And now it has a photographic sweep, and it looks like two shop lights from Home Depot. And that's where he photographs all these girls. So we walk into this, where this television is, and he turns on the TV, and I see that I'm standing there. Lada Ladushka is standing there, and he's standing there, and I can see us on the TV.
Oh.
I look up, and there's a dome camera. And he hits the remote, and he goes, click. And you can see the hallway outside his apartment. Oh. Click. You can see the outside of the apartment building. Click. You can see the parking lot where his car is. Click. You can see the corner. It's like, how far down the rabbit hole does this go?
Were you creeped out?
I was starting to get really creeped out. And and he goes, coffee. I go, coffee. So we go into the kitchen, and he takes his jacket off, and he's got a 9mm strapped to himself. Now he's been taking photographs of me all day with this incredible camera with this huge lens, and he's got this 9mm. He drives like James Bond. And at that moment, when I saw that gun, I went, either KGB or Mafia.
Yeah, one of the two.
And it's like, wow. Anyway, so have the coffee. He drives me back to where we're staying. And he says, I give you address where you can get the photograph I take. And he writes this address down where I can get the photograph. And he goes, it is under Leon Kopinski. But that is not my real name. And zoom, he drives off.
You're like, I am out of here.
Wow. I've never experienced or been on the edge quite like that before.
Are you thinking at some point in time during this whole experience that you're going to have to take off your top and get a photograph of you? All right, we're going to move on to the next one. I like that story. Here we go. Leland ripped open the back of his pants during a performance.
That is true. There was this set piece on this, it was a very big theater, if I recall. And I think they had been doing Into the Woods or something. They had these trees that were cut out, silhouette trees that were all cut out. I backed into it during the performance, and they were just raw pieces of wood. And it grabbed my pants and just like ripped the butt wide open.
Oh.
So I just sort of continued on and but stayed sideways. And then I got to this the backstage area where I have the screen set up, and my wife was there. And I turn off my mic and I go, "Get some tape, get some tape." And she gets some gaffer's tape, and she gaffer tapes my butt up. And I was able to finish the show.
All right, next headline. Leland juggled glass eyes at the optometrist's office.
That is a lie.
Oh, no.
I think it should happen.
If you saw a bowl of glass eyes, would you juggle them?
I would want to. I would just, here's looking at you.
Hello. All right, we're going to go to the next headline. Leland is American Indian and born in Afghanistan.
That is true. Mm. That's a fact. My father was a Shoshone Bannock, and my mother's from the Bad River Band of Chippewas. Mm. And they met at the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
They had an affair at the Indian Affair.
That's it. I always say that my mom's name was B, my father's name was Boyd, and I'm here because of the Boyds and the Bees.
That's good.
I had it was such an adventurous life, and one of the things that happened while I was there was I was walking through downtown Dar es Salaam with my father. My father and I were just walking through the city, and I looked up this pillar, and on the pillar was a poster that said, "John Calvert, famous Hollywood magician."
Sure.
I said, Dad, he's an American. Mm-hmm. Can we go? And sure enough, we went to see the show, my mom and dad and I, and John Calvert, if you don't know,
I do know,
is one of the most dashing and charismatic guys that's ever walked the stage. Hmm. And he did hypnosis, hypnotized people, turned them into chickens, and he cut off an audience volunteer's head with a buzzsaw, threw the head into the audience. My mother caught it and threw it back, and then he restores the head.
Oh.
And it was an indelible memory. Well, I got a chance to shake his hand, of course. And at that time, he had two big cats as well. A leopard, I think, and a cheetah. A leopard and a lion, that's what it was. Years later, I was in Springfield, Massachusetts, talking to my friend Ray Goulet, who ran a little magic shop in Watertown. He said, "So who's the first magician you ever saw?" I said, "Well, first magician, it was John Calvert." And he was like... I said, he had his own yacht. He came into Dar es Salaam Harbor. He goes, "John Calvert, he's a friend of mine. I've been on that yacht." I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, we're having a special dinner for him next week. Do you want to go?" I went, "Do I want to go?"
Yeah.
I had gigs, and I canceled them, and I rearranged things so I could attend this thing. It's 40 years later, right? And I get there, and I realize, oh, he was maybe in his mid-40s when I saw him as a kid. Uh-huh. That means he's almost 90 or 90 or more. I said, oh, this isn't going to be good. So I prepared myself for disappointment. Uh-huh. John comes out on this little cabaret stage, and it was like he was still charismatic. Oh. He was still there. His presence was amazing. Mm. He did his classic cigarette producing, and his he stole a watch. He did a blindfold where they blindfolded him. And this guy's in his 90s, right?
Yeah.
And he was doing the blindfold act. They did a little and I'm just agog. And after intermission, when they start their second half, his wife Tammy comes out and goes, "There he is. There he is, John." And John Calvert comes out and says, "You, young man, stand up." Mm-hmm. I said, "This young man," he said, "saw me when he was 10 years old in Africa. You mm-hmm. see, all those stories are true." And after that, John and I became fast friends. Oh. And I assisted him doing the buzzsaw act at the Orleans in Las Vegas. Then on his 100th birthday in New York City, they had a big magic conference, Magic on Manhattan, and I staged the whole buzzsaw act for him and performed it for him. He gave me this tremendous hug afterwards, and it was just a fantastic moment for me, and it was wonderful to have someone that you considered sort of a magic hero befriend you like that and share so much with you. It was really nice.
That must have been something. A lot of the folks that I've interviewed have talked about the first magician they saw or the first performer they saw. For example, Steve Trash, who is a magician that does magic with recycled items, famous in the magic world. The first person he ever saw was Philippe Petit.
Oh, yeah.
And you're saying one of the first people you ever saw was John Calvert. And I wonder if that's a common theme of successful entertainers, that the very first person, the bar was set very high with the first person that they saw.
Yeah, the bar was certainly high with Calvert. He was one of those people who could make an audience member practically do anything.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
Now, full disclosure here, I got to tell you and be honest with you, I didn't make any of those up. Leland wrote those because they were hilarious. And when he submitted those, I said, "You know what? You've done my job for me. So I don't have to write any of those. Thank goodness."
Great.
Thank you, Leland, for doing that. I appreciate
You're it. You're welcome. Absolutely.
Now, do you have some advice for the beginner?
Yeah, I would say for a beginning performer, you really need the art of mime. You need to know how your body communicates and how to use movement. So many performers, and especially a lot of magicians I know, don't have that skill. And it's a skill. They're techniques. And they serve you so well. They just make you more believable in what you do. And I think that's one of the most important things you can have as a base, no matter what you do. If you go on to do other things in theater with mime and movement as a base, you'll have ammunition that you wouldn't have otherwise.
And how about for the working pro?
For the working pro, I think don't be afraid to reinvent yourself. I think as you age, as your career develops, you have to be willing to transform yourself and change and take on new ideas and new risks. If you don't, you have the option of becoming stale, not really being able to call yourself an artist, really. An artist is a creative force. You need to be creative. And one of the ways to do that is by reinventing yourself and taking a good, strong look at your own persona and see how you're changing through time and make it part of what you do.
Now, give us one book recommendation and tell us why.
Well, I think it's Mime Spoken Here by Tony Montanaro and Karen Hurl Montanaro. I think it's an invaluable resource because it's not just theory. It's things that he actually put into practice that really work.
Okay, I'm going to put that on your show notes on my website so that way someone can get a hold of that.
Sure.
Well, thanks, Leland, for doing my podcast. You're terrific.
Really wonderful, John.
Thank you.
It's great that you're giving the artists a forum to talk about stuff.
Oh, thanks. And I got to tell you, all these professionals that are on that I'm interviewing are giving, including yourself, are giving great tips and great stories. So the people listening win too.
Well, good.
Now, where can someone get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you for a performance? Or, you know what? Actually, even before I ask that, where can they get tickets for your newest show?
Well, my newest show, I'm going to be performing at Wabash College in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you can get tickets from Wabash College at the theater department there.
Okay. And then where can they get a hold of you? What's the best place to get a hold of you?
LelandFaulkner.com or Leland@LelandFaulkner.com.
Beautiful. And thanks to all my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, tell a friend. That's how we can spread the word. Also, make sure to get your free audiobook from audible.com. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book to get your first book for free. You can reach me at my email at john@thevarietyartist.com or join my Facebook group, which Leland just joined today.
Yay!
At The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.